Case number 09-1270, Cheryl A. Taylor et al. Petitioners versus United States Department of Agriculture et al. Mr. McCarron for petitioners, Mr. Barco for respondents.
Mr. McCarron, if you could wait just a moment.
Certainly.
I think people are not quite settled. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court. I'm here on behalf of the petitioners requesting review of the U.S. Department of Agriculture's decision finding them responsibly connected under the USDA statute, it's the Perishable Agricultural Commodities Act, PACA. That statute was amended in 1995 to provide a statutory basis for challenging a finding of responsible connection. And what that statute did in terms of the issues here today is that it incorporated this court's law with respect to nominal officership and alter ego. The statute also added an actively involved standard, but that's not an issue here today. The judicial officer did not decide the actively involved standard because he found that the petitioners were not nominal officers and that this company was not the alter ego of Arthur Hollingsworth. However, the basis for the petitions for review is that the USDA judicial officer violated the statute here. First, with respect to the nominal officer issue, the statute specifically says that if there's evidence to show that one's a nominal officer, then they're not responsibly connected. In this case, and that means a nominal officer means an officer in name only, and that is that officer has no power. He just has that officer just has a name. And there's case law on this from this circuit. In many cases. The seminal case is Quinn versus Butts in 1976, in which this court held that persons have a right to challenge this kind of a determination by showing that that they're only nominal officers, that is, they don't have any power, they have no authority or power, or that the company is the alter ego of another. And that's been consistent throughout this court's case law. And as I said, it was adopted by Congress. In this case, the judicial officer did not look at that, at whether or not these individuals had power. There was 8 witnesses that testified in this case. There was no evidence in contradiction to those witnesses. It was undisputed that these people had no power. Instead, the judicial officer decided on factors that are wholly irrelevant to whether or not a person is a nominal officer. He looked at their titles, which has nothing to do with power. He looked at their actual power.
Well, I don't. I think it's a bit much to say it's wholly irrelevant.
Well, it's initially
make it more likely that they were not nominal officers if somebody had the title of vice president versus no title at all.
Well, I'm not sure anybody could be an officer if they have no title. I've never seen a case where somebody has no title.
Well, it's relevant. It's relevant. It's one piece of evidence. It may not be conclusive, but it's certainly relevant.
It may be relevant, but it has to be tied, I think, to their actual relationship with the company, to whether they really had power.
It's not wholly irrelevant.
All right. Then the background of the individuals, which is his view of it, the judicial officer's view of it, was that their background indicated that they could be real officers. Again, he never indicated that they were real officers. He just said they had a background that they could, if they were real officers, they could exercise it. And then he also turned to the compensation. And again, none of these factors were tied to whether or not these individuals actually had any power. And that is the fundamental problem with the decision. It says nominal officer, and that is a well-known concept in the law, and it means a person's power. And there's just nothing there that supports that finding that they had the powers of an officer. The second test.
How is your the argument that you're making consistent with our recent case, Kleiman and Hochberg? I guess it's
Kleiman and Hochberg.
Right. There we said there wasn't a knowledge requirement. So doesn't that sort of change the argument?
No, I don't think knowledge makes any difference. What I think the court said was that it doesn't matter that they didn't know of this bribery in the Kleiman and Hochberg case. It doesn't matter because they were real officers. They actually exercised power in the company. So the argument that the petitioners in that case were making was, well, we may have been real officers, but we didn't know. Well, that's not this case. That has nothing to do with this. This case has to do with whether or not they're nominal officers, first off, and whether or not they had the power of the office. In Kleiman and Hochberg, they didn't. The second phase of this case is about the alter ego. And the judicial officer decided, without really any review of the evidence, at least there's no indication in the decision that there's any review of the evidence, that this company was not the alter ego of Arthur Hollingsworth. And again, there was undisputed testimony from 8 different witnesses who were involved with the company that said Arthur Hollingsworth made every decision in this corporation, every single decision. And he did this through an individual named Darren Miles, who he appointed as the president or the CEO. And he also did it through these sham board meetings he would hold where he was making all the decisions, and then he would cook up minutes that would demonstrate or try to demonstrate that he wasn't making these decisions. All of that evidence was there in the record before the judicial officer, and none of it was considered. So it's impossible to really say how he came up with the decision that that this was not the alter ego of Arthur Hollingsworth. The only thing he says is that this was not viewed by anyone as the alter ego. However, everybody that testified indicated that they that Arthur Hollingsworth was the alter ego in effect by saying that he made every decision in the case. So it's on those bases that the judicial officer erred, not properly interpreting the statute, not in fact disregarding the plain meaning of the statute as far as nominal officer goes, and in terms of alter ego, not reviewing the evidence, not relying on the evidence. Well, that's all I have, unless anyone has any questions. At this point, I've reserved 2 minutes.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. McCarran.
May it please the court, my name is Andrew Varco. I represent the Agriculture Department. I'd like just to start on a minor point, but I think I'd like to qualify something Mr. McCarran said. This court has held that the alter ego doctrine of past C-Circuit case law was adopted by Congress in the 1995 amendments. This court has never squarely considered, so far as I can tell, whether every jot and tittle of cases such as Bell and Quinn was adopted, nor, so far as I'm able to tell, has the JO ever decided that question. But it's true that JO has repeatedly, as in this case, cited, relied on, discuss Quinn and Bell. Well,
I was going to ask you, do you think the actual significant nexus test actually survives the 1995 amendment?
I think that the JO continues to use that language. Whether he uses it in exactly the same way as it was used in the prior two cases, I don't know. I'm not saying that there's a departure here from that standard. I think under the Brand X decision, the agency would be entitled to depart, but then it would have to explain its departure. Here, I think the facts are so different that there was no need to consider that question. And then just on what the testimony says and the board minutes, I don't think if you look at the evidence in the record appendix cited by Mr. McCarran, I don't think it says, and we went through this in the brief, to some degree, that Hollingsworth made every decision in the corporation. There was quite a bit of evidence supporting the judicial officer's conclusion that although Mr. Hollingsworth was a dominant figure in the company, the board was in control. It was a real board. And as to sham board meetings, whether the board meetings were shams was vigorously disputed before the JO, and the JO obviously ruled that they were not shams, that they were real board meetings.
Can we get to the nominal officer? Because I just can't figure out how the judicial officer could reach the conclusion based on the standards that were applied. It's not consistent with our case law as I read it. I think there's one statement in the opinion that says if you have the title, that's the end of the consideration. That does it.
I don't think the judicial officer stated that the title alone makes someone a more than nominal officer.
You characterized it as an alternative ruling?
There is a statement at the end of the opinion.
Yeah.
Which is not in conflict with any of the prior decisions because no prior decisions involve publicly traded companies. But there's a statement at the end of the discussion on page 20 of the appendix, page 14 of the JO's opinion, where he states that while the evidence in the record regarding Ms. Taylor's position and Mr. Finsberg's position is sufficient for me to conclude that each was not a nominal officer, the fact that each was identified in the SEC filings as an officer makes it difficult for me to conclude that they were only nominal officers. Therefore, I hold absent very extraordinary circumstances, et cetera, et cetera. An individual who is an officer of a public company and identified as one in the SEC can't be found to be a nominal officer.
In my reading of the judicial officer's opinion, three things were considered: background, titles, and knowledge. And I don't know how that gets you there with no consideration of power.
Well, the judicial officer...
Background surely can't be controlling. It may be something you look at. Titles certainly alone are not controlling, certainly something you're looking at. And the knowledge, if anything, in this case would seem to me cuts away from your position and doesn't help you. And you take the knowledge from a different case, different set of circumstances, and try and apply it here. There's no consideration as to whether or not they really had the power of an officer.
Well,
if it is, point me to it.
Well, I think the entirety of his discussion does indicate that he was
the
considering...
The entirety of the discussion is about backgrounds, titles, and knowledge.
I actually would disagree with you on that.
Well, that's why I say, your time, point me to it, yes, where he's talking about they had real power. I'd missed it.
Okay, well, at the top of page 16 of the appendix, he says that one of the factors he considers in determining whether someone's nominal is the disparate levels of power and authority,
yeah,
between the officer and the individual who appoints him.
Where'd he do it?
Where'd he do it? I think that remembering that it is the petitioner's burden here to show that they had absolutely no power at all, he found that there wasn't, that they had not met that burden.
Well, I said, what else were they supposed to show here? They were not actively involved.
Whether they're actively...
They were not actively involved in any of the power decisions with respect to the matters that we're talking about. And indeed, when they tried to counsel on these matters, they were rejected summarily.
Well, here I'd like to draw a distinction, Your Honor. As you know, that the statutory definition has two components, and one is whether the person was actively involved in the activities that led to the violations.
Right.
That's not at all at issue here.
Right, I understand.
And moreover, the fact that there are two separate requirements that it's the petitioner's burden to meet indicates that the mere lack of active involvement simply isn't enough. It must be something different.
They put in testimony indicating we carried a title. We were not involved in any of the power decisions of the operation. Now, where is that contradicted? The contradiction that the JO purports to offer is, well, look at their backgrounds, look at their titles, and they knew about the bad events here. I'm saying I don't get it.
Well, they interacted with the board of directors. They appeared regularly at board of directors meetings.
Secretaries interact with boards of directors. So what?
Not as officers and not in a way that...
Not as officers, yes, is the question.
Yes.
That's a title.
They were involved in policy making decisions
where?
For the company.
Where?
Where? Well, I think...
Back to these matters at issue. Where?
Right at the top of page 14. They did try to persuade the board to comply with the PACA, but that's not the standard. Whether you're powerless to prevent the violations is not whether you're nominal or not. In Kleiman and Hochberg...
I'm trying to understand where it is that you've shown that they have any kind of power, authority to exercise power at an officer level. Where is it?
Well, I think even in their briefs, the petitioners concede that they were involved in refinancing and directing SEC filings. Ms. Taylor was secretary of the company and signed all the board minutes and signed the SEC filings as SEO, as CFO.
All of this is pretty much spelled out, but not in the judicial officer's opinion. It's in the ALJ's opinion.
Right, but the ALJ's decision is part of the record on which the JA.
Well, I think the best argument you have is that just this cryptic reference, while the evidence in the record regarding their position is sufficient, but without the judicial officer said that in a couple different places, but he never told us what evidence in the record other than the matters that Judge Edwards is referring to.
Well, I think he's implicitly rejecting the notion that that efforts to stop the violations are inadequate. But I would rely on that statement, that the evidence about their positions just wasn't enough for them to meet their burden.
It would have been sufficient. Your argument would have more force if the only thing that the judicial officer said was affirmed.
Right.
I don't think that the fact that he offers more reasons or more clarification.
The problem with the judicial officer's opinion is it states a test that, as I read our case law, is not correct. It's applying the wrong test. I mean, Judge Randolph's right. If he or she had stayed with the ALJ and say, I don't have anything more to add, then it would look like a fairly easy case. But the judicial office purports to rely on a test that makes no sense to me and does not include an analysis of power.
Well, I think I would rely on our briefs for this point. I don't know I can persuade you further, though I won't concede the point. Thank you. Does the court have other questions? I'll give the remainder of my time to the court.
I would just note that the judicial officer did not adopt the ALJ opinion. The judicial officer, when he does so, specifies that he adopts the opinion of the ALJ. I'm not even sure I would concede that, I would not concede that even the ALJ's opinion is sufficient with respect to the nominal officer standard. There just wasn't any evidence to show that these people had the power of the office, and that is that's the fundamental test. Nor was there any evidence.
The burden is on your clients.
That's correct. We have the burden by preponderance of the evidence, but it was all undisputed. There was no other evidence to the contrary. And similarly with the alter ego test, there was no evidence to the contrary to substantiate the judicial officer's conclusion that this company was not the alter ego of Arthur Hollingsworth.
Maybe the judicial officer just committed a harmless error by failing to incorporate the ALJ's decision.
I don't think so. The judicial officer is very clear, and we note that some of the cases, when he adopts the opinion of the ALJ, he says so, and then he modifies that opinion with certain insertions and the like. That did not happen here. He did not mistakenly fail to adopt the ALJ opinion. He adopted his own opinion.
Based on the record.
But what does that mean? That based on the record, the whole idea is he has to set forth his reasons and the evidence, and at least for you to review.
Does he have to set forth his reasons?
Absolutely. How can you?
He just can't say affirmed.
No, I don't think so. I think he could say I adopt the ALJ opinion, and for those reasons, I affirm. Yes, I think he could do that.
Well,
but he didn't.
Suppose he doesn't even do that. So he just says affirmed.
Well, I don't know if that's sufficient.
We do that.
I know, but in this just for speculation purposes, is that the kind of reasoned decision making that this court wants to see out of agencies? I mean, just to say affirmed, I guess we could, and then we'd go back to the ALJ's opinion and parse that.
Exactly.
But that's not the case here. We have his own opinion, and he has his own standard that he adopted, and it's just incorrect under the statute. And under your case law.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Please, this honorable court now stands adjourned until tomorrow morning at 9:30.
Mm-hmm.